probably 60 will finish up tomorrow when we talk about trials. I wanted to kind of limit what you need to study on that for the exam, and I'll tell you which pieces you should be responsible for with respect to 60 when we get there. But let's talk about a motion for new trial. So I think the easiest way to do this is to compare it with what you know. Now, we are talking in this section about not only things that dispose of the case, but dispose of the case or deal with the case post-trial or in trial. Okay, so judgment as a matter of law is the only other one we really learn in this context. So motion for summary judgment, 12b6, those are earlier and separate. This is while you're in trial. All right, so motion for new trial. Is it the same or is it different from Rule 59? Rather than clicking in for this first one, let's just talk about it. Let's see who we have. Trek, help me with this one. Can a plaintiff or defendant file for this? Yeah, both can file for this one. So this one's the same as the JMOL. The only thing that's different, actually, is there's one additional party that can also move for new trial who can do that. Do you know, not party is probably the best way to describe it. One other thing, entity can do it. That's right. The court can. And so we'll see that the court here can sua sponte do this. They're going to have the same timing restrictions. We're going to see some ability for the court to move for 60, a Rule 60 motion, but not entirely. There's only certain parts of 60 a court can sua sponte do. All right. So when do you file this? The rule for JMOL was 28 days from entry of judgment. What's the rule here? It's the same. So far we're pretty good as far as this rule. What about pre-judgment motions? Remember JMOL, you had to make that one because it was the renewed motion later. Do you have to do something like that for this? No. That's right. There's no pre-judgment motions. That's where they differ. There's no like motion and preservation and renewal of one. Grounds we're going to get to in another moment because there's some similarity. One thing I'll tell you that is similar is there's an evidentiary challenge under both. Because we're at trial, we're looking at the evidence that's coming in, but it operates differently. The standard's not the same. So that one's going to be not the same, but we'll get to it in a second. If granted, if we get a JMOL, we get the judgment from the moving party. What happens if we grant a motion for new trial? You get a new trial. So is that the same thing as what we get from a JMOL?
No,
well, in fact, they won't. The nice thing about new trial is what you're trying to do is it's sort of the do-over. It's the, okay, we went through trial and we think the jury probably got this wrong. How often are we going to give this to you? Not very often, but it's easier to get than judgment as a matter of law because we're not saying they got it so wrong that we have to grant you judgment. It's just that they got it wrong. We think we should give you a do-over. Okay. It doesn't seem like a reasonable judgment, but we couldn't say that no jury could ever reasonably look at this any other way, like we'd have to for judgment as a matter of law. So all you get is a new trial. The stakes aren't quite as high, so while it's not something you get very often, you'll get it more likely than you'll get judgment as a matter of law. All right, so let's go ahead and see if I can get the clicker thingy to come up here for a second here. And we're going to go ahead and click on this one from your worksheet. It's according to the language in Rule 59A1. For what reasons may a trial court grant a new trial in a jury case? Is it A, only to prevent a gross injustice? B, any of the reasons for which a new trial has heretofore been granted in an action at law in federal courts? Or C, both A and D? And if we can actually get the clickers to work, you can click in. Otherwise, you should know the answer. So talk with someone on what answer you think that one is. Yes. Okay. So A, B, or C here? Okay. A, B, or C? It's like a lure. Okay. Yeah, I'll give you like 20 seconds on this one. Okay, if you haven't already, go ahead and click in on this one. Okay, good. good. This one is B. I have a couple of people clicking on the either ones, but the majority of you have this one right. This one is B. Now, what does that sound like as a standard to you for any of the reasons for which a new trial has heretofore been granted in an action at law in federal courts? Is that a very clear standard? No, it's not really easy to apply, so we have the Dedarian case to show what that really means. So this is what the rule tells us. It means you need common law, because it tells us reference common law to get the rule. So if you're to write a rule statement, you need this, but you need to know you have to go into common law. All right. So if this standard is met, is this something that the court has to do, or is it sort of a may? What do you think, Trek? It is a may. It's a may. All right. Okay, so what really then are the grounds? The rule tells us look to what has been done. What does the case in Dedarian tell us are typically the grounds for a motion for new trial? Excellent. Against the clear weight of the evidence. The other way you hear this phrased often in cases is against the great weight of the evidence. So if you're ever doing like a Westlaw search, either of those terms will lead you to this whole area of the law. That's typically how you see it phrased, clear weight or great weight of the evidence. All right, there are other grounds for giving someone a new trial. What would they potentially be? Why don't you finish this one off, though? Okay, excessive damages awards, uh-huh.
There's a procedural irregularity such as defendants being wrongly admitted or excluded. There's incorrect jury instructions, or if there's newly discovered.
Okay, so newly discovered evidence is the last one. The middle one is sort of procedural irregularities, and gave us examples, evidence, and excluded jury instruction error. The one I added that he doesn't have in here, which you often see, is attorney misconduct is another one here. So you should know that one. And then newly discovered evidence is the last. So there's those three other big categories in addition to clear weight of evidence. Now, the one you see the most often is the first one. Because if you think about it, it's not, you know, in every case that you'll be able to really argue you've got excessive damages, that you have procedural irregularities, or that something new has come up. We'll talk about the newly discovered evidence when we also talk about Rule 60. His section, just to give you a little heads up, his section on Rule 60, he's got like the test for fraud and for newly discovered evidence. Those are the two you're going to have to know about. His stuff on mistaken there is actually the case he gives you, I think, is a definite minority rule. So don't focus on that. In fact, you know, kind of just cross that one out when you get to 60. The reason I mention that is because it's this aspect. Counsel misconduct. He puts a case in there that says, oh, the counsel was acting sort of inept, so you should get a vacation of your judgment under Rule 60. Like, that never happens. I'm surprised he found a case that actually said that. In fact, all the other cases, if you research this, will generally say, even if your legal counsel is completely in malpractice, you don't get vacation of a judgment. What you do is you sue your lawyer in malpractice. So be very cautious in that section and think of misconduct as maybe a way, if anything, to get a new trial. That's much more likely. Otherwise, we would have people undoing judgments all over the place, arguing that there was some inept counsel behavior. We don't want that to happen. We'd rather just have you sue your lawyer. Okay? And at best, get a new trial. So keep that in mind. Let's focus on number one, since it tends to be the most often used one, and we'll return to the other ones in a moment. So against the clear weight of the evidence. All right. If you look at it, we're back to that original kind of comparison. We're in the grounds section now. There was an evidentiary basis for judgment as a matter of law. And now there's an evidentiary basis against the great weight of the evidence in our new trial. So how are they the same and how are they different? Let's remind ourselves of what Rule 50's evidentiary standard was. And then we'll turn to the Dedarian case and talk about what we see in Rule 59. What was the evidentiary basis? What were we kind of considering when we looked at the evidence? We're asking for judgment as a matter of law under Rule 50B. How do we look at that evidence? What kind of standard do we put it to? Do you remember what the standard was there? When we did on Tuesday? What was it? Anybody? Yeah? Sure.
The court may be a sense of positive determination that no reasonable jury could find.
Oh, and it may be, so it's generally not sui sponte, it's the motion. So, but the court deciding on motion, that renewed motion is judged as a matter of law, that no reasonable jury could find on this evidence that we've seen evidentiary support of your proposition. That's the first part. No reasonable jury can look at the evidence that we've had before us and see that you have an evidentiary basis for your claim or your defense. And then one other thing, because it's judgment as a matter of law, what else do we have to show? Remember? Yeah.
The party's claim or defense under controlling law can only be maintained or defeated with a favorable finding.
Good. And that's the rule language exactly. I think it's kind of awkward rule language, as they say it can only be found with a finding on this. I think a better way to think about it is you can't win without what we just said you couldn't prove. That's what it is. So the first part is you have no evidentiary support that a reasonable jury could find for you on this point. And secondly, you need to win that point to win at law. So when we think about negligence claims, like in our Parsons case, if you think about breach, if reckless moved for judgment as a matter of law on the grounds that when looking at all our evidence of breach, there's nobody who can really affirmatively tell us that a reasonable jury could say that he was driving erratically or swerving, he'd win on that point and say, and the law requires that she proves negligence, proves breach in order to win her claim. And so because she doesn't have evidentiary support of her breach analysis, she can't win negligence. You see how that is? That's the two-part. That's what we're looking at, judgment as a matter of law. Because we're basically saying, and it's after the entry of judgment, which jury went the other way, we have to look at the evidence under a certain light. What kind of light do we take it in judgment as a matter of law? Who do we view in favor of?
The light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Yeah, because the non-moving party, during a renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law, what was the answer from the jury about that non-moving party? Did they win or did they lose? The non-moving party. They won. That's why they're not moving for judgment as a matter of law. They just want the judgment. So basically what we're saying is we're taking the evidence in the light of the person who won at trial, because that's who the jury said should win. So we view any kind of inference in favor of the non-moving party, and then we can look at any evidence that the moving party puts on that's totally uncontroverted and unimpeached. Okay, but if it's been controverted in any way or been impeached in any way, we infer against it. Okay, so that's kind of what we're doing with judgment as a matter of law. What are we doing when we've got new trial? Well, for that, let's look to that Dedarian case. And this is one of those, like, quintessential famous cases, like every casebook on the planet in CivPro has this case in there. So you'll see it a lot in your horn books and study aids. If you have trouble kind of following it because it has some different aspects to it, I encourage you to look at those. I think it's a great case because they actually move alternatively for judgment as a matter of law and trial, and that's what typically happens in suits. So it gives you a very usual paradigm, but the court actually does a really good job, I think, of comparing them as motions, which is why it appears in every CivPro book. All right, but let's go ahead and talk about what happened in this case and how they're dealing with the motion. Okay, Mr. Greer, you want to help me with this one? What went on here? What was this about? Kind of like who's suing who here and for what?
It was about jewelry, and it's the insurance company not wanting to pay for it being stolen.
Okay, so who's suing who then?
The insured is suing the insurer.
Very good. So and that's important to keep in mind. Keep that in mind so we get back later to why they're not going to rule for judgment as a matter of law in favor of the insurance company. That fact will come back again. Okay, so it's Dedarian suing the insurance company, and then the insurance company, in its defense, and this is important, is raising what? Dedarian says, I had insurance over jewelry. What happened to jewelry in his argument?
It was supposedly stolen.
Yeah, he was like in a big robbery. He was shot in the arm, and they took all this jewelry. It was very expensive, and he wants the insurance proceeds from the jewelry. The insurance company investigated the claim and then said, we're not paying for you. And what was their defense?
They had actually had two.
Very good.
One was that he didn't initially purchase. And
so this jewelry that's missing was never there to begin with, okay? Yep, what else?
And the other had to do with how he obtained the money to buy it.
What were they saying about how he obtained that money?
Sure, I know.
Well, in the end, ultimately, he says, I got it through these, like, bonds and through loans from a bank. And the bank person says, and we'll talk about what he says in a moment. Basically, the answer is no, is the punchline to that one. And but they're saying at trial, then therefore, what did you say about the source of your money? How would we characterize it? Truthful or false?
Right, they were saying that he had lied.
Yeah. So that's their defense, that he lied. Now, why is that important for the basis of the contract you owe me on the insurance contract? Because that's not a claim in a breach of contract argument, right? That where did you get the money to buy for the jewelry, right? The claim is really, did you insure this stuff? Was it triggered, the contract obligation? Stolen is one thing that you trigger coverage for in an insurance contract. Then you owe me, you haven't paid for me, therefore you're breached. That's what the claim looks like. Why are they saying about whether or not he actually got this money or that money is relevant to whether they have to pay him?
Well, the contract wanted his cooperation and that to basically aid in figuring out what happened and so that the insurance would not pay unless he helped them.
Very good. As part of the contract, he has to assist in the investigation. And that makes sense because the insurance company is really at a slight disadvantage.
And if you have the insurer doing anything that kind of hides the nature of the situation, it doesn't allow them to properly process claims. So one aspect they have is you have to participate honestly in all the investigation. And if you lie in any part of the investigation, they have that as a right to refuse payment. So that is not part of the claim. That's what would you call that as far as a legal lawsuit goes? What are they presenting when they say that? It's not part of the Darien's claim. It's their what, you know? That's not spelled out in the case, but what do you think? It's their argument. If we were to label what their argument is, not a claim, it's a
defense.
That's right. And it's a certain type of defense. That's exactly right. What does an affirmative defense ultimately mean? That's exactly right. Very good. Now, make sure you write that down. That's not spelled out by the court, but it makes a difference as to the reasoning on judgment as a matter of law. Who has to prove the elements, prove the burden on he lied about where the source of the income came from that purchased the jewelry? That's an affirmative defense. It's not a part of the contract elements. It's not Darien's job. It's the job of the insurance company to say, you had to do this, you didn't do it. We're raising our affirmative defense, therefore we don't have to pay you. And so it becomes a couple things.
It's an affirmative defense. Proof is on the side of, the burden of proof is on the side of the insurance company. They're the defendant raising it. The other aspect is it was material. It would resolve the dispute one way or another. Because if they win on their affirmative defense, do they have to pay him? No. If they lose on their affirmative defense, do they have to pay him? Depends on whether he can prove the claim. But it is material because it would support the defense. And if they win on that affirmative defense, they don't have to pay him. They basically had an attack of the claim itself. You know, you didn't really have the jewelry. Therefore, there was no basis to really insure you. That's the claim itself defense. That's not really an affirmative defense. It's just a defense they raise against the claim. Then they have their affirmative defense. You lied about the source of the money. Okay, we're going to get into the details of the evidence about those two arguments. But does everyone understand those two? Okay. So, who wins at the jury level? Because we're on appeal here.
I can't remember his name, but the insurer.
Yeah, D is fine. But like the Darien D is fine. He wins. How much does he win? $267,000 plus interest, because it's an interest-bearing kind of judgment. And they found for this in what we call special verdicts that we'll talk a little bit about in our next class. Juries can render things on either general verdicts or special verdicts. A special verdict specifically is lined up to ask questions that would lead you to the ultimate answer of whether this person should recover or not. And in those claims, in those verdicts, you can clearly see they agree with him that not only did he purchase this jewelry, that he had a good basis, the money, to purchase it. Okay? And we get to the end, you know, you can think to yourself, like, what was this jury thinking? I don't know. I have a feeling, you know, D here is very polished in how he argues about stuff, because it sounds to me like after the bank gets up here, and they heard the bank testify about what he said he actually, you know, used as far as the money for his jewelry, it's very, very, I don't know if I would have gone that way on the jury. All right. The defense raised a motion. They actually raised two. What did they raise here? Just so we have it.
It was the one we're studying right now, 59.
Yeah, the one we're studying right now, which is the new trial one, and then the other one.
Also 50.
Yeah, and at the time they call it JNOV, that judgment non obstante verdicto, because remember it was mid-90s when it changed over in the federal rules. So I should always know what everything is called, because when you go do research, you can't be like, well, they changed the rule yesterday, and I expect only cases that talk about my language, because it's the same thing. It still applies. It didn't change the operation. It just changed the name. So they were, it's for your purposes, a judgment as a matter of law, and alternatively, for new trial, because they really want to win judgment as a matter of law. This is an alternative argument. They don't really want a new trial, but they'll take it over having to pay. What does a trial court rule on those motions? They grant them or deny them?
I'd like to say they actually denied them.
I'd like to say so as well. They did deny those motions.
$67,000 they probably denied.
Yeah, they denied them. They denied them. They reinstated the jury verdict stood. There was no effect to the jury verdict. There's no new trial. That's how it is. They appeal. Because that's now a final judgment, so you can appeal from that. And we just spelled out here what the two bases for the insurance company was. One, they never purchased the jewels. And second, their affirmative defense that he lied about the source of the money. All right, so let's talk about then what the appellate court is doing, our court in the case book here, the First Circuit. Okay, on the initial ruling that he never purchased the jewelry to begin with, as far as the judgment as a matter of law or JNOV verdict, what does the appellate court uphold? Do they say that this was, we should grant judgment as a matter of law, or no, we shouldn't? What's their ruling? A, yes, we should grant judgment as a matter of law, or that should have been granted, that's how you should read it, or no, it shouldn't have been. So don't look at it as upholding yes, no. Look at it as yes, it should have been granted, no, it shouldn't. Yes, we want judgment as a matter of law, no, we don't. What do they end up saying, our appellate court? Yes, we should have granted it. No, we shouldn't have. Okay, go ahead and click in if you haven't already. Thank you. All right. Okay. So they say, no, it shouldn't have been granted. And that's the right answer here. Why was this something that we shouldn't have granted, that the trial court really got right? This should have been a denied motion. Yeah.
Because the weight of the evidence doesn't say that reasonable jury couldn't have found only one way. They could have made sense that they that he had actually purchased the jewelry. Wasn't that just so blatantly obvious that he did purchase it that the jury couldn't have found any other way?
Okay, good. And then let's talk about how you'd actually write about that and explain about it. Like, if I gave you the jury facts as a test question, how would it have looked? Well, you want to state your standard that there's, you know, no reasonable jury could find for the person. The evidentiary basis isn't there for this. So what would you say is the analysis? What facts would you say a reasonable jury could have found in favor of Dedarian that we shouldn't be giving judgment as a matter of law to the insurance company? What evidence did they have that was supportive of that a reasonable jury could say, no, he didn't mislead about the purchasing, that he actually did purchase this jewelry? What could you say there? Yeah.
Testimony from the jeweler and his employees, he was in there and purchased it.
Yeah. He testifies himself. That's not as persuasive since, of course, he's the one that's really interested to get paid out. But the person he purchased it from also testified supporting that, in fact, he purchased the jewelry. Not only did that guy testify, his two employees also corroborated that, in fact, these were purchased items from their shop. All right, so all that, you could say a reasonable jury could say, no, all these people are lying, but they could also find these people are accurately reporting this such that we're not going to disturb that the jury found it that way. Okay, so it's reasonable. I think one other tricky point he had was that there were no receipts for any purchase of the jewelry. And sorry, but when you're purchasing like $267,000 worth of jewelry, something I've never done, but I can speculate, you likely walk away with some documentation of that event. This guy had zero, like none, not just the jewels. There was no, like, I don't know, like I said, I've never purchased jewels of this amount, but I typically get when you do that. Yeah.
And he only also had $3,000 in, well,
We'll get to that in a minute, because I think that gets to the source of income even more so, of like, where did he get this from? Because he files the IRS. I don't have $3,000 in income at all in a year. Well, then maybe you shouldn't be buying jewels. I don't know. But, okay, so that's the issue here. People, how do you deal with the receipts? How do you respond to that?
The jewelry store said that they usually don't give receipts for cash purchases of investment jewelry or consignment.
Yeah, you can already start to see why the insurance company was really skeptical of all this. Oh, yeah, that's right. We have a receipt process, but not when you pay in cash. In cash, we don't write anything down. So you can see, like, they're a little bit worried about this company as well as him. And that's why they're arguing no reasonable jury could have believed this, because this just seems very shady, right? But the jury could say, no, it is, because it's cash, it's consignment, they might have a different way of operating it, we can just perceive that that's accurate. That's why the insurance company saw it the way they did. The Darien does have at least three people, and they say that the process is consistent with what happened. Whether that's good business practice or not is at least consistent with what they said. And the jury believes them. We're not going to disturb the jury verdict. So that stands. What about the motion for new trial? Does the appellate court think there should have been a new trial? Yes. Or does the appellate court think there should not have been a new trial on the question of whether he ever purchased that jewelry? Just on the question of whether he purchased the jewelry, taking both those issues separate. Do they think, yes, there should have been a new trial, or no? And start with it on, I gave you the page reference for a reason. So start with like how they're applying it in this situation. We'll talk about what they ultimately get to in the end. Anybody else? Okay, good. We have 80% with this one. Initially, they say no. And on the reasoning of this thing, if this was it, you wouldn't have gotten a new trial. Ultimately, they're going to get a new trial on this, so we're going to hold our reasoning for a moment. They find it's too wrapped up with the thing they're going to grant new trial on. But if it had only been this, there would have been no new trial. Why? Because they feel like it isn't, the conclusion of the jury isn't against the manifest way of the evidence. They don't go into a lot of explanation because they know ultimately what they're going to do on the other facts. So we'll hold it for now. But I think you would use basically the same facts you just used. And you'd say that this decision isn't against the great weight of evidence because there's sufficient evidence to support the jury verdict. And name what it is. Those employees, how himself, and the process that they testified to that when you do cash purchases, we don't give you receipts. All that's not the decision of he did purchase jewelry is then therefore not against the great weight of the evidence. There's evidence to support that. All right, but let's look at the other one, the question of whether he lied about the source of money. As far as new trial, let's take that one first. Does the appellate court think there should be a new trial on this or not? Because we do new trial first. That's what they really are going to think about here. Do they think there should be a new trial or not? Did the district court abuse their discretion in denying this or not? Should there be a new trial? Yes? No? Okay, good. This is the one they grant here. Now let's talk about how you'd actually describe it, how you'd apply it, what facts you'd look to. First, you'd want to state your rule that to grant a new trial on an evidentiary challenge, the evidence, the decision, the jury's decision has to be against the great weight of evidence. That's the rule. Okay? In order to give you a new trial on this first ground, you have to show that the jury's decision is against the great weight of evidence on this issue, on the issue of did he lie about how he got the money to begin. Okay. And they say it is against the great weight of the evidence. It is against the great weight of evidence. That's why they get a new trial on it. So how would you apply it then? Because that's, of course, what separates grades and people. So we need to figure out how you do that. It's how would you actually say, other than telling me, it is against the great weight of the evidence, how would you do it? What would you point to? Well, what are we looking at? What decision are we looking at? Did he lie about the source of income? So we want to first probably start with, well, what did he say? Okay? And then look to contrary proof. What did he say about where he got the money to begin with? Yeah.
He got it from the loans from the bank.
Okay, got it from the loans from the bank. Now, is this sort of like, how did the event occur? Let's kind of play it out, because it gives us context for whether or not someone's accurately reporting something or not. Was this like they rushed up to their door, he'd never heard about their fact that they're going to challenge his claim, and they say, tell us where you got the money from? Nah. Is that what happened?
No. They said he had a certain amount of time. I forget how much exactly.
Like months.
Months. Mm-hmm. And he pulled together the little promissory notes that he found, and he said, those were the time period. He was like, this is what, this link to this one. He kind of tried to link them together.
Okay.
Promissory notes with the.
Yeah. So let's spell that out then, because this is how you do it in trial when you're wanting to argue to the court why they should grant your motion. You want to do something more than say, just look at it. It's so against the great weight of the evidence. It's not as persuasive. You want to spell it out. Now, how do you pinpoint someone who's lying? Because that's what you're having to prove. Not a fun thing to have to prove about somebody, but every time you impeach someone on the stand, it's the same thing you're trying to prove. Well, you want to point out, especially since lying proof is not just that you're wrong. That's one aspect of it. But also that you had some motivation. Because you can be wrong and mistaken, and that's not a lie, right? I had a pure innocent reason for doing it. It's not a lie. So you have to show, first of all, it's wrong. And then you have to show that they knew it. Okay, so how do we prove it's wrong? He does the pulling the promissory notes out, talking about which pieces of jewelry he bought with which note. Pretty compelling testimony at first, right? You know, that's pretty nice. Okay, then clearly you had some money to do this. All right, so how do we know it's wrong first? Because we have to at least show it's false to get a lie. Mm-hmm.
The bank, the testimony from the bank who said that these were just renewal previous loans and he would have gotten no new money from them.
Okay, so they look at each one and do the same and say, well, the first batch of these ones, these are renewing loans. There's like no new money that comes from them. So there's no income. So that couldn't have been used to purchase anything because it was nothing, no money from that. Well, the other ones, what do they say? There is one that does have some money bearing on it, but he does what with it for the bank? The bank just doesn't, you know, give you these things and goes, you know, have a great time. You know, yeah.
Some of it they put in an account that you made small draws off of, and another they put into a corporate account which is used for those things.
Okay, so he has two purposes, the interest-bearing ones, the ones that have income on them. One is an account which he has pulled money from, but only small denominations. So clearly it doesn't amount to $267,000. It could have come solely from that, right? The other one, he puts it in a corporate account and says, for purposes of real estate. Now we know that this isn't real estate. So that's, so far we've at least gotten the first piece, that what he says he purchased the jewelry with, these loans, these promissory notes, couldn't have done that job. Because either they had no money attached to them, or he didn't pull enough off of them, or they were already listed for real estate acquisition, which is not purchase of jewelry, okay? All right, so we know it's wrong. Is that enough to show lies? No, because he could be mistaken. So now we have to identify why it's a lie, okay? Why? How would we say it was a lie here? What kind of proof of motivation? To mislead. Yes?
One, he wasn't asked to put the stuff on the spot, and when he testified to the links between the loans and the different jewelry, he said it was with certainty, so there was no question about it until he was actually confronted with evidence.
Until he was caught. Okay. So there's several pieces there, so let's spell them out so we can find ways to find good evidence for you in the future when you go to practice. One thing you do is you say, well, was he in a situation that might create mistake? Why might you be mistaken? Or might you say something with certainty, or at least say something and it might be inaccurate? When you're rushed, okay, when you're under a stressful moment, you're being investigated, you didn't even know about it, they're kind of the first moment of investigation, like, well, I don't remember, but I think blah, 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 blah. Okay? That's probably not a lie. Shouldn't do it, but not a lie. Right? Not a lie such that it would give the affirmative defense the grounds it's going to give them. All right, so it wasn't that way. And there's actually one fact no one's mentioned yet that I think even makes it worse. Who brought up the issue of the promissory notes as the basis for acquiring the jewelry? Who said, hey, that's where that came from?
He did.
It's not like the insurance company said, hey, we think you used it for the promissory notes. Can you get them together? He brought it up. He goes, this is how I did it. He had a lot of time to pull them out. He pulled out specific ones. Not like he came with a big stack. And then he sat there under detailed examination and said, this is the nice one that I got, that nice emerald piece. That was this much money. And I remember it. Oh, it was so grand. And then the second one, and this is what I did. Okay, liars are bad about this because they tend to give tons of detail. Right? Lots of detail suggests motivation. Because he wasn't ever saying anything that would sort of hedge his statement. He didn't say, you know, I don't really recall. It was a time in my life when I was into lots of jewelry and I just purchased it willy-nilly. And I can't remember if it was this one or some other thing I have underneath my mattress I purchased it with, but I'm trying my best. He doesn't make any kind of limitation on his statements. He's really certain. Until the banker gets up there and goes, well, I'm a banker, I have copious records, and I follow every dollar and cent everywhere, and let me tell you, there's absolutely no way you could have purchased it with this. And then he goes, oh, I totally forgot. I was kind of just willy-nilly telling you which one fit. I'm sure it's somewhere else. Okay, so you can understand why the insurance company had some pretty good evidence. All right, so what does this mean for, like, the most immediate thing you're going to have to do taking the Civ Pro exam? You want to look at what needs to be shown substantively, you know, the evidentiary basis. What are we trying to show? We did it in this situation, which was fraud. So you're not going to always do, like, was it wrong and did he lie, because that's only relevant for things like fraud. But let's say I did it for persons, right? How would we identify whether or not, let's say we win and Reckless moves for new trial, and he wants to argue again on that breach issue. What would you be looking for to show that the jury verdict might have been against the great weight of the evidence? Well, first of all, you want to do is identify what it is has to be established. And in a negligence case, what is it you have to establish? What's your legal piece? Breach. And what is the, because if you can prove all the elements, let's just say he's only really looking at breach and saying it wasn't sufficient. All he has to do is pick one, because without all of them, we can't win, right? So if you can unravel one, you can show that the verdict shouldn't, you should at least get a new try. All right, so let's say breach. What do you have to show on breach? What do you have to show to prove breach itself? Okay, that's our evidentiary standard. Substantively, like, if you're talking about tort class for a second, what do you actually have to show breach? That someone did what? That's what we have to show. So it's not a judgment, an exercise of reasonable care. So taking an unreasonable risk in light of foreseeable harms, whatever you like to phrase it like in your tort class, I don't care. But that's what it is. So oftentimes I will tell you, if I give you law, I don't either do one of two things. I pick the classes that you've already taken, and I still generally give you the standard so I don't make you have to remember back to those classes. Like, oh, she picked the class I hate, and now it's Civ Pro plus that in one exam. Blah. So I try and do that. The other thing I sometimes do is something like the dairy, and I pick a small area of the law that I think if you read it, you could pick it up. But if I told you they have to show this guy is lying, and lying requires both that they're wrong and that they're motivated to lie, I'll tell you that in the exam, and then ask you to use the facts. Because I'm not worried about the substantive argument. I'm worried about, can you show that that fits the process, the need for a new trial? So if we stay with reckless for a second, we know what breach is. You don't even have to get it 100% accurate, but something about reasonable care somewhere in there. And you'd say, why would it be against the great weight of the evidence? Well, what would we look at? You can make it up. What kind of facts might there be so that reckless could say, hey, they resolved it in a way that's against the great weight of the evidence? If we win, and it's against the great weight of the evidence, yeah.
If there were a lot of affidavits and testimony from witnesses that said that he was really exercising reasonable care.
Okay, so we have to, it's at trial, and remember we have our judgment, so we're not even looking at affidavits anymore, that's the summary judgment, that's discovery, but it'd be their testimony, like you mentioned, Lance. And so, what would the testimony read like? Say, he wasn't speeding. He didn't change his lanes. Whatever our theory is, that there's at least some witnesses, and what you want to say, if you're going to prove great evidence against the great weight of the evidence, you have to show it's more than just one guy, right? So you try and argue, look, there's so much here, it's against the great weight of the evidence, all right, in order for reckless to get a new trial. Do you understand how that works? All right, so that's why it worked in this case. But then we go to judgment as a matter of law. Now, does the appellate court say on that second grounds, lying about the source of the money, is that something that we should give him also, the insurance company also, judgment as a matter of law. Because remember, that's what they wanted. They wanted judgment as a matter of law and alternatively new trial. Did they say also JMOL? Okay, anybody else? Okay, good. And I'll tell you right away, this has to be the answer, right? Because can you get new trial on the same thing you also get judgment as a matter of law? No. Why would that be wrong? Why would that be like I'm going right and left at the same time? Why is that wrong? It can't stand together. Because we can't say do-over plus you win at the same time. You see that? It's something like those inconsistent stuff we talked about. But that would be a bad ruling from the circuit court here. You couldn't do it. So they say no. But they actually say, you know what, we thought it was really close here. And that we granted you new trial, but we didn't think we should give you judgment as a matter of law. And the reason they don't is in part because of the nature of the difference between the two. How wrong you're saying the jury was and how absolute you think the evidence really is. All right? They say kind of it's a close call on this evidence to say whether or not it's at such a point that no reasonable jury could find for Dedarian. I mean, certainly he's got an uphill climb, right? Because he did a lot to really make himself look like he was telling lies. He also reported on his tax income return, we mentioned before, that he makes $3,000. So he's got to come up with it somewhere, and it just looks like lying, probably to a lot of people, including the IRS. All right, but who bears the burden of proof on this issue, on this thing about lying about the source of the money? Who bears the burden at trial on that, Mr. Greer?
Lloyd.
That's right, Lloyds of London did, because it's their affirmative defense. And so the court here is saying, when it's the person moving who ultimately bears the burden at trial, are we more likely or less likely to give them judgment as a matter of law? Less likely, because remember, who did the jury find for? The other party. That's why you're asking for judgment as a matter of law. Remember, this is the renewed judgment as a matter of law. After the jury returned the verdict in favor of the Dedarian, and you're saying, we should have really won. But you carry the burden at trial, so it's really pretty hard for us to say not only did the jury not get it right, but that you, who bear the burden, should win. And the other problem, and why they, I think, tip the scale, even though this, I'm telling you, there's a lot of evidence this guy lied, is that it comes down to credibility. Do you believe the banker, or do you believe Dedarian? Because you can't believe both. You know? And at least come to the same conclusion if you think they're both reporting accurately just can't work. Either there was money from those loans or there wasn't. Yes.
At the next trial, and they're asking him the questions, but could he then change in the beginning and start saying, oh, well, I'm not really sure, or is he going to have to say the same things he said at the
original? Well, he's sort of stuck in a difficult situation, because if he starts now under oath, remember his first was at trial, it was under oath. He said, this is what I use, I'm so certain of it, this is, you know, this long story. He gets in a second trial and he says, I didn't ever use that, I used something else. What's likely going to happen? Two things. One, he's potentially subject to perjury issues because you can't, obviously, swear under oath to do different things, unless it's not a lie. See, perjury is not just, I was mistaken, I'm okay, but either way, it's still a problem. We call that impeachment. And when you get to evidence class next year, you're going to learn that you have in your hot little hands waiting. You just can't wait for him to get on the stand and tell it because you have his transcript. And you get to go up there in cross-examination and say, do you remember on this date when you were also sworn under oath and you testified blah, blah, blah? Did you not say blah, 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 blah? And is that, in fact, different than what you're saying today? Yes. And you're going to go through every single little thing he's saying consistently. That's what impeachment looks like. Impeachment's a long and painful process of watching someone get stuck in misstatements or bias or other things. All right? So that's what's going to happen.
So he just wouldn't take a stand?
Well, what if he doesn't do that? Can he win if he doesn't testify as to where he got the money, do you think? They're raising it as an affirmative defense. And if they put on evidence that says he never, ever had the money, he reported $3,000 to the IRS, he's shown us nothing, do you think we've carried our burden as lawyers of London on our affirmative defense? Yeah, pretty much I think so. So if he doesn't come forward, what's likely to happen then they're probably going to win, either by the jury or by a directed verdict through judgment as a matter of law. At that point, they've offered nothing. We have all the evidence, so he's stuck. He's in a bad, bad, bad situation. Which is why you counsel your client way before this, when they first call you and say, hey, I have this jewelry that got stolen in this fantastical story. They're starting to investigate it. And you get in with them then and talk about the dangers of misleading and, you know, doing all the stuff he did. This would be the not fun person to represent. But these are the people that typically call you. Because the people who have, like, everything in line don't need a lawyer. So you're generally up there being like, yes, yes, and you're trying to make this better. But there's really no way at this point. I mean, if you look at it practically, he's pretty much in a corner. He might get a small settlement because Lloyds just might want to avoid going to new trial. That's why they really wanted to win a judgment as a matter of law. New trial means they're actually going to be put forth through litigation again, and that's expensive to them, and so it'll probably at least get them to settle for what it would have cost them to litigate. So, he might still get something if you're worried about him. All right, the courts, and not that you shouldn't be, but if you are, he's probably going to get that. All right, what's the court's final conclusion on new trial? Here's the weird part. They actually grant new trial on both, ultimately, because they say, well, we didn't, if it was only on the first issue, would we have given you a new trial? No. But because that's so integrated and wrapped up with, you know, where did you get the money? Did you use it to buy jewelry? It's so intertwined that you're essentially going to get a new trial on both aspects. So the defendant actually walks away a little bit better than they would have anyway, because they're getting a new trial on both. Neither judgment is going to stand. Okay. So let's do some comparisons before we call it a day on this. Okay. So if we think about standards for new trial on the evidence, the judgment as a matter of law is no reasonable jury could find for them, that there's no evidentiary basis for whatever issue they're trying to prove. For new trial, it's just you ask if it's against the great weight of the evidence. It's not just if you would have looked at it, would I have ruled differently? It's, is it against the great weight of evidence? There's a couple different tasks this makes you do, though. I won't make you click. We'll just talk about it. In which one is the judge permitted to actually weigh the evidence? Judgment as a matter of law or new trial? In new trial. That's why it's against the great weight of the evidence. We actually weigh it. Okay? Can you do that as judgment as a matter of law? No, you can't. So judgment as a matter of law, no, you can't weigh it. New trial, yes, you weigh it. All right, is the judge required to view the evidence and draw all inferences in the light most favorable to the non-moving party? Well, earlier in the class, I gave this one. Hopefully we remember. All right, so judgment as a matter of law, do they have to weigh, view the evidence in favor of the non-moving party? Yes. Have a yes. What about new trial?
No.
That's right. They don't for new trial. All right, so for those of you who are visual learners, I have this sort of in a little graph. All right. Let's assume that Dedarian wins at trial. When is judgment as a matter of law for the defendant appropriate, and when is new trial on the great weight of evidence appropriate? Well, if you look at it this way, I tried to depict it as this is the preponderance of the evidence standard that Dedarian would have to meet in order to win. And so the jury is finding that the evidence here at a spectrum of from no evidence at all that the plaintiff has in their favor to the best evidence in the world, they have to at least get here. All right? Judgment as a matter of law is represented by the blue arrow. It's really you're saying that we're so close to that he practically has nothing that no reasonable jury could find for anyone other than Lloyds. Okay? So if we look at it as a spectrum, everything favors Lloyds of London versus everything, or everything favors Lloyds of London versus everything favors plaintiff, we have to get down to everything almost favors Lloyds of London to give them judgment as a matter of law as the defendant. New trial is somewhere in the middle, but still probably closer to judgment as a matter of law. What you're thinking of here is that it's not that no reasonable jury could have found for Dedarian. It's just that when we look at the evidence, we think it's something less than the preponderance, really, and now getting not just a little less than the preponderance, but against the great weight of the evidence. Because it's not far from this. If you're in this area, then you're just saying, I would have done it differently. So the judge is like, hey, you know, I don't think that's a great decision. You still uphold the judgment. You don't give new trial. If you think about it, that was the, did he actually purchase jewelry? Yeah, it's kind of fishy, his story about whether he actually purchased this stuff, but there's lots of people testifying to it. It's not against the great weight. But did he lie about it? He's up there detailing everything, and there's absolutely no way he used it. That's at least new trial. But not quite at no reasonable jury, because they carry the burden on that issue, and it's a credibility determination. You get a new trial. If you think about it, the judge is doing less in, injury to the verdict here. Because you're not giving judgment, you're just getting a new trial. So we let you have more discernment. You're weighing the evidence. You don't have to view it in favor of the other side. That's what it kind of looks like. If you're not a visual person, don't look at the chart again. It's fine. You know, if you understand the concept, that's great. I don't care if you know the chart. So, like, don't be one of those people like, I hate charts and tell me what the error means. Just ignore it if you understand the, like, rope, like, outline piece. But if you're someone who has trouble with that, that's how you kind of want to look at it. Where's summary judgment? Well, it's probably closer. We added all the evidence on the other side in favor of the plaintiff. Closer to here, you know, we're kind of this window around the preponderance standard. That's kind of where summary judgment's at. All right. So that's where we're going to wrap up with today. All we've got left on new trial is just those last couple. There's two questions that are tying up excessive damages and the process new evidence, those two quicker questions, and then Rule 60. And as I told you, as you're reading for Rule 60, of the 60 grounds, the only ones I actually want you to substantively know are 2 and 3. B2 and 3, which is the newly discovered evidence and fraud. Those are the only two you actually have to know for the exam. So we're going to focus on those. B2 and B3. All right. See you tomorrow.
So we don't have to know.
Right. No, as far as 60, you should know 60. But as far as 60B goes, know the substantive elements of B2 and B3. There's not much else to 60, though. Just like timing and that's it. Let me just close this down.
Okay.